We take technology for granted, not just the powerful computers we walk around with in our hands, but the structures that make our lives easier. Think about the bridges we drive across every day. It wasn't that long ago that building a major bridge like the Brooklyn Bridge cost many workers their lives. Fast forward a century to not a bridge, but a tunnel, and not for vehicles, but for sewage. That is the story that unfolds in Neil Swite's book, Trapped Under the Sea. The tunnel allowed Boston Harbor to become much cleaner, but at great cost in dollars, and even in human lives. Neil Swite is a staff writer for the Boston Globe magazine. He's a teacher at Tufts University. He's the author of The Assist and the co-author of a book about the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Neil Swite, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
It's my pleasure, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
So, Neil, is it just me, or is Boston getting a reputation for tremendous public works projects?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the one that the national attention is most drawn to is the Big Dig, which was became synonymous with government cost overruns. You know, this project that was supposed to cost $2 billion and ballooned to something like $17 billion at the end. This project that I write about had a much lower profile, but in many ways a much more significant impact on the region than the Big Dig. It was the method for cleaning up, as you referred to, Boston Harbor had been the filthiest urban harbor in America. It's now considered the cleanest urban harbor. It's an incredible renaissance that has been produced by this cleanup of the entire region. Because so much of the work was done underground, and not just underground, but under the seafloor, way out at sea, most people have no idea really what happened there.
Oh, because unlike the Big Dig, it wasn't digging up city streets and rerouting traffic and all that sort of thing.
Absolutely. I mean, there was one, there are two components to this cleanup effort. One, people see if they fly in and out of Logan International Airport, which are these giant egg digesters. They're egg-shaped, and that's where the sewage treatment, the sophisticated process, happens. But the thing that nobody sees is this tunnel, which is the world's longest tunnel of its kind. It starts 420 feet down below the earth and goes into the bedrock hundreds of feet below the seafloor and goes out for nearly 10 miles. And unlike most long tunnels in the world, this one is a dead end. So it is much harder to build because you don't have the opportunity to build from both sides and meet in the middle like most big tunnels are done. You have to build only out, one way in and one way out.
People who are not from the Northeast might not really get an idea of how filthy Boston Harbor was. I mean, there was even that song years ago, "Man, I love that dirty water, Boston, you're my town."
Absolutely. And what people might remember if they're students of presidential politics is in the 1988 presidential campaign, the filth of Boston Harbor went from a regional issue to a national issue because the candidate, the Democratic nominee, was Mike Dukakis, who was the governor at the time of Massachusetts, and George H.W. Bush, the vice president at the time, running to be president. His campaign stumbled on this as a campaign issue. They ran a commercial that just pretty much showed the filth of the harbor, the open sewer that it had become. And most of your listeners learned in school about Boston Harbor through the Boston Tea Party, where the colonists dumped their tea to protest British rule. It was the economic power of early colonial America, and it was the connection to the old world. But it had become over the centuries this open cesspool. And the Bush campaign capitalized on that by essentially showing that footage and saying, is this the guy you want running your country? And it was, even though it was unfair politically because work had begun on the cleanup, it was fair in terms of this being actual, authentic, disgusting footage that showed just how bad things had become.
It really did look like a fetid cesspool, and your descriptions in the book are quite evocative as well. So obviously there was a need for this tunnel, and is it, you make a reference to most of the toilet flushing in eastern Massachusetts ends up there?
Absolutely. Every toilet in the half of the state will end up at Deer Island, which is this peninsula that hangs down like a comma into Boston Harbor above Logan Airport. And that's where this massive sewage treatment plant, the second biggest in North America, was built.
So the environmentally conscious are going to be asking at this point, what comes out of the end of that tunnel?
So that's a good question, and there was concern from the environmentalists while this was being proposed. Basically, the underpinning of the project was to rectify the sins of the harbor, which had become so foul and fetid because barely treated and sometimes untreated sewage had been dumped daily into the harbor, unceremoniously right into the harbor, and that's why it became the filthy cesspool. So the goal at the beginning of this was to get it as far out, even after you've treated it very well, extremely well in a sophisticated way, unlike before. The goal, even then, with clean effluent, which is the treated wastewater, was to get it as far out into the wide-open Atlantic waters of Massachusetts Bay and to do it in a way that diffused it so that it might not hurt the marine life out there, the flora and fauna, and just be able to kind of move out into the sea.
All right, so treated, but a long way out at sea and on the ocean floor. We'll talk about how deep that is when we come back and talk more with Neil Swidey. He is the author of Trapped Under the Sea, One Engineering Marvel, Five Men, and a Disaster, 10 Miles Into the Darkness. We'll get further into what the disaster was as we go further into this discussion with Neil Swidey. You can join us on The Exchange. We'll talk more with Neil and you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Neil Swidey, Boston Globe Magazine staff writer, teacher, and author of a couple of books. His latest one is called Trapped Under the Sea, One Engineering Marvel, Five Men, and a Disaster, 10 Miles Into the Darkness. It's about the completion of a very long tunnel to carry treated wastewater away from the Boston area to help in the cleanup of Boston Harbor. But the tunnel went straight out to sea, under the ocean floor, and required some fairly tricky procedures at the very end. We'll talk about that in just a moment. You can join this discussion on The Exchange as we talk about this particular incident and other massive public work projects and their dangers. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So here again, the sewage treatment plant on Deer Island, this tunnel out under the ocean floor. How long and how deep down? I mean, how far under the ocean floor? How deep is the water where the tunnel finally ends?
So the water at the end point is between 100 and 200 feet. And so it's below that, and then 100 to 200 feet below the seafloor into the bedrock underneath the ocean.
Wow, so a long way down and a long way out. And then we've talked about what's supposed to come out at the end. It is treated sewage, but basically what they're doing is it's kind of like laying perf pipe in your garden, but much more sophisticated than that. So this tunnel goes out. It starts off large enough for vehicles to actually drive in, and ends up how big at the end?
Yeah, it starts out 24 feet wide in diameter, and at the end it chokes down to just 5 feet in diameter. And then, even more crucially, it connects this long horizontal pipe of the tunnel connects with these 55 vertical pipes that climb up to the ocean floor through the bedrock above the tunnel. And each of those pipes is just 30 inches wide.
And so, Neil, had anything like this been attempted before this project in Boston?
No. What's interesting about this is that this was engineering marvel. It was a pioneering approach to dealing with this massive problem. It's since been used as a model for similar mega projects as far away as Hong Kong, and they've learned from what happened here in Boston. But it also attracted some of the best and brightest minds in construction and engineering design, some of the biggest, most established companies in the world.
We made the reference at the beginning to previous large-scale public works projects and how dangerous they were, things like the building of the Brooklyn Bridge and previous tunnel projects that cost lives, particularly when the sandhogs would hit soft sands, there'd be blowouts. Had we reached a point in engineering where we tended to minimize the risk, or is there still great risk in these kinds of projects?
It's a great question, and on one level, we're much better and much less tolerant of preventable fatalities on big projects on this for a couple of reasons. Because it used to be there was this chilling shorthand that people in the tunneling world had, which was a man a mile. When you built a 10-mile tunnel, you should expect to lose 10 men. And as you say, these big projects, these monuments to civilization cost many, many lives, you know, not just back in the pyramids, but, you know, the Hoover Dam was about 100 lives were lost on that. But over the 20th century, there was much more attention paid to safety and to doing things with more thought put into them, and also to the enormous costs when you do have a fatality, financial as well as the human toll. So all those combined to have created an environment where today the goal on big projects is to have zero fatalities, even though there's lots of risk embedded in these grand projects.
And Neil Swidey, were you covering the events in the construction of the tunnel along the way as a regular matter of course, or did you know much about it until they had to send these guys in to go down to the end of the tunnel? And we'll talk about why in a second.
What's interesting is, so I'm from here. I'm a native Bostonian on here. At the time of this story, which was 15 years ago, I was living in New York. It was a few months before I moved back to Boston, so I had just missed this. But when I came back, and I didn't hear about this story until many years later, and what's interesting to me is that wasn't just a consequence of not living there at the time. All my colleagues and journalists, they weren't aware of this, with a few exceptions on that, because of two reasons. One, it happened the same time this project and the accidents on this project that I write about in Trapped Under the Sea happened at the same time that John F. Kennedy Jr.'s plane went down. So if you can remember that, both regionally and internationally even, that was this enormous story that took all the media's attention, you know, the son of Camelot.
Sure, yeah, it would have diverted all the attention, particularly in a place like Boston.
Absolutely. And the second part was, you know, the survivors of this tragedy had never spoken publicly about it. And so even the people who were equipped or deputized to be able to explain the story to the press at the time didn't really know what had happened, because the only people who did were these people who were too traumatized really to talk about it.
So the building of this miles-long tunnel, 24 feet in diameter at the beginning, five feet in diameter at the end, with these pipes going up to the ocean floor, what were these guys going in there to do?
So yes, that gets us to what happened here. So, and one of the things that really drew me to this story was how very smart people can make very bad decisions, and workers in hard hats have to bail them out. And here was a project that, as I said, drew the best and the brightest minds from around the world in construction and engineering, but at the who made a host of really good decisions to both envision this project and then enact that vision by building it. But then at the very end of the project, the various parties could not get along. There were all these pressures and all this distrust and all these financial overruns and calendar dates and deadlines blown, and those conspired to create a sort of cauldron of dysfunction on this project, where the people in charge couldn't get along and really weren't even talking to each other except through tersely written memos. That created this situation where the last stage of this project, which is a multi-billion dollar project, the last stage of it was left undone. And the whole project wouldn't work unless this relatively small piece could be taken care of. And that was when that long, 10-mile-long tunnel connects with those 55 vertical pipes that climb up to the ocean floor. At the base of each of those, at the elbow, really, where those horizontal and vertical pipes connected, there were a series of safety plugs, these big, bulky stoppers that were in there. And because of this dysfunction on the job, those safety plugs, those stoppers were left in after everything else, all the life support utilities, the ventilation, the lighting, the transportation in the tunnel that kept the workers who were building the tunnel alive for the decade that they spent building it, all that had been ripped out. And yet those plugs at the end of this black hole of a tunnel had to be taken out. And that's when they turned to a group of commercial divers and asked them to do the impossible.
Which is the story of Neil Swiatie's book, Trapped Under the Sea, One Engineering Marvel, Five Men, and a Disaster 10 Miles into the Darkness. This is a discussion you can join on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So it just seems, did you find any person who said, well, I thought somebody else was going to deal with this decision? I mean, did it ultimately get down to one person who didn't say, well, let's get the plugs out before we remove the life support?
What's interesting, as I was saying about the level of communication that was happening at the end of this project, being done in these tersely written memos, is in some ways, for my purposes, kind of going back forensically to understand what happened here, it was haunting in some ways to see these memos that predicted the doom that actually happened, and by some of the same people, including the contractor that opposed this plan to remove all the utilities and life support before they had taken those plugs out. There was actually a memo that I reference in the book that predicts if you do this, if you make us follow this sequence of taking all the ventilation out of the tunnel and then sending in a group of workers to remove these plugs, the risk of catastrophe will be exponentially higher. And yet that same contractor at the end decided to go along with this provision in the contract that required it to do this, to follow that sequence of pulling all the life support out and then sending in the workers to remove the plugs, and had kind of, in this sort of eerily prescient manner, predicted what actually happened.
I guess we need to explain just a little bit then about when we're talking about life support. When you have a tunnel that is blind at one end, as this one is, and only 5 feet in diameter there for that matter, and the nearest opening is 10 miles away, it's not like there's lots of abundant breathable air in there.
Absolutely. So at the time of this project, when these divers were sent in, the tunnel, they didn't send in divers because of the water. The tunnel hadn't been filled yet. So there was a couple of feet of standing water that had kind of seeped in through the bedrock over the course of construction. But there wasn't, that's not why they sent in divers. They sent in divers because these guys know how to do dicey construction jobs in settings where they have to bring in their own breathing air. Because at this time, at the end of the tunnel, one or two breaths of the ambient air in the tunnel would be fatal. It was that toxic of a tube by that point.
Wow, that's. We'll talk about why in just a second. Let's take a call here. We have Mark and Redding on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Neil Swiatie about Trapped Under the Sea.
Yes, what's the useful life expectancy of this tunnel?
Oh, that is a good question.
It is a good question. So figuring that the problems that they had in Boston had a lot to do with using old equipment and not updating them. At one point, when the harbor was disgusting in the open sewer, the Smithsonian Institution reached out to the people running the sewer agency and asked for a particular pump, and they were told to their astonishment that the people in Boston couldn't part with it because they were using it every day, this incredibly ancient piece of machinery. Having said that, the tunnel was built, I believe, with a life expectancy of about 100 years, that it should be able to be used for that.
And this project began in the early 90s, was it?
It did, yep.
All right, so upon completion around the year 2000, then at the end of this century, they're looking at perhaps another tunnel.
Right. Yeah.
Yikes. All right, so you call these the divers, and again, this is not a dive mission, Navy SEAL-type guys. Were any of them, in fact, SEALs?
There were no SEALs on there. There's one guy who actually is not far. He lives in Northern California, not far from your listener area. He was a Navy veteran, but not a SEAL. But they were guys who it's a remarkable small fraternity, mostly guys, although some women who do this work in commercial diving, which is kind of because they do it so far from the surface, most people don't know much about it or don't know unless you live in certain areas of the country like Houston or down in the Gulf. There aren't many commercial divers in your mix, but these are workers who do really difficult jobs that would be tough on dry land, but yet they're doing them hundreds of feet below the water, and in the case at the highest level of experience in the field, which is called saturation divers, these workers will spend up to a month at a time in a pressurized bell that goes down as far as 1,000 feet under the water. And they sleep in this pressurized bell. There are bunk beds in there, and then they go out in their dive gear and work on a pipeline and then go back in, and they don't come up until 30 days later. I mean, but they work so far off the radar from the rest of us that we really don't appreciate just what they're being asked to do.
At that kind of depth, are they breathing a mostly helium mixture?
They are, yeah, down there, and that's why. So they'll have communications, and I'll with some of these divers I've gotten to know quite well, I'll hear from them because they'll have email access. But if I was talking to them through a communication system, they would sound sort of like Daffy Duck, you know,
the helium voice, yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So you mentioned that the air in the tunnel, the outfall tunnel from Deer Island, away from Boston Harbor, you said that the air in there was toxic. Was it toxic because of the seepage, or toxic because it just didn't have any oxygen in it, or why?
Yeah, it's so far out that the oxygen, the good air, can't get out there, and there's no flow for that. And then there's algae and other things, and if there is rust out there from some equipment or bolts that were in there, that can sort of consume what little oxygen is left. So they had to, before they took on this job and before all the ventilation system was pulled out, they had a fact-finding mission where they sent the divers at that point. About half the tunnel was still ventilated and half from the most eastern point had been pulled out, so they could go, and they ventured somewhat into this distances where the ventilation system wasn't there to test, to see what was there, to see if there were any dangerous explosive gases. But really what they found was just the oxygen-starved nature of the tunnel at the time.
Almost like being in outer space from the sounds of it.
Really, it's exactly right. And in many ways, these divers were sent to the moon. It just so happens that the lunar landscape they had to contend with was 10 miles into the Earth rather than orbiting around it. But they were that far and that disconnected from the surface. I make the comparison in the book to the deepest ocean point on Earth is the Challenger Deep and Mariana Trench in the Pacific Ocean. And that is straight down, but that's 6.8 miles. So the end point of this tunnel was nearly 40% farther from the surface than the deepest ocean point on Earth. I mean, granted, it was mostly horizontal and not vertical depth, but it was pretty much, the distinction was not that meaningful, because that's how far they were from getting back to the surface and back to safety.
It's not like the, you know, the mine cave in movies you see where, you know, it looks like, you know, the daylight's just over there. This is a long, long, long way away. And, Neil, did you ever get a chance to get into the outfall tunnel yourself before it was put into use?
I didn't. So immediately after this project was done, they filled it. And now up to 1 billion gallons of treated wastewater flows through that tunnel every day, and I call it an engineering marvel for a reason. That's not hyperbole. It moves that 1 billion gallons daily without a single pump or electrical source inside the tunnel. It's all gravity. That's the force that moves it through, and moves it through brilliantly. And so, but the tunnel had to be built with precision, absolute precision, in order to make that work. I was able to go into other tunnels that were being built at the time, smaller ones, certainly, since the scale of this one was not something you find very often. But yes, this is not even the most adventurous human being would be allowed to venture into this tunnel.
A long way down and a long way out. That is the story of Trapped Under the Sea, one engineering marvel, five men, and a disaster 10 miles into the darkness. We'll talk about the ultimate focus of the mission to get to the end of the tunnel and remove those plugs to get it into operation. Neil Swite is our guest on The Exchange, and we'll take your phone calls and talk more with Neil when we come back to The Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Neil Swite. He's a staff writer for the Boston Globe magazine. He teaches at Tufts University. He's written or co-written a couple of books. And another one just out is called Trapped Under the Sea, One Engineering Marvel, Five Men, and a Disaster 10 Miles into the Darkness. You can join us on The Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So to set things up again, because the sewage problem and the just pollution generally problem in Boston Harbor was so bad, a new sewage treatment facility was constructed at Deer Island in Boston Harbor, and an outfall tunnel sent 10 miles out to sea under the sea floor. And because of the poor relations between the people in charge of the project, it got to the point where when the last thing that needed to be done was ready to be done, they had to go down, workers had to go down 10 miles to the end of this tunnel and remove the plugs so that the tunnel could actually be used. And that's the story that Neil Swite is telling us. And we have an email here, Neil, from Johnny, no town given. He says, I sailed in Boston Harbor in the late 50s, early 60s, when the effluent was released at Deer Island. Sometimes if the tide was wrong, you were literally sailing in the middle of raw sewage. You could see just what you flushed down the toilet floating on the surface. Decidedly unpleasant. You didn't want to capsize or get near the water under those conditions. Deer Island has quite a history as a dumping ground in the Boston area, doesn't it?
It does, and that's a fascinating part to the history of the story, and I could have written a whole book on that, but I restricted it to just part of one of the chapters. But basically, it's almost a metaphor, the Deer Island, for what a society does with things it doesn't want to think about. Most recently, that's been sewage. We want to have advances in society. We want to have big houses with multiple toilets and bathrooms, but we don't want to think about what actually happens to them. But in history, going back to during to colonial times, it started out with Deer Island, where during King Philip's War, which was the colonists versus the Native American tribes, the colonists actually rounded up all of the Christianized Indian villages. So anyone who sort of bought into to the colonist spreading of the Bible and started these praying villages that kind of rung Boston. When war broke out, the colonists, even though the Christianized Indians had kind of come over to their side, the colonists couldn't trust them, or the leaders felt they couldn't trust them, so they rounded them all up and sent them out to internment camp out on this Deer Island, because it was just far enough away from the city and where people had settled that you could put something where you didn't want to have to think about it. And it was a brutal, punishing winter, and about half of them died out there. Created this history, a kind of sad, sordid history of Deer Island, of some pretty shameful acts that happened there. And then in the 1800s, there were other things that came in. So if there were Irish immigrants that came in, that they were worried about disease or other issues, they kind of put them out there. When there was a leper colony there, there was a prison run out there. Anything you didn't want to have to think about, you kind of put out there until it got to the point where it was just sewage. But as the emailer said, it wasn't that long ago that really kind of shameful behavior of just dumping this raw sewage into the harbor was a daily occurrence.
That's just amazing to think about. But obviously the harbor is a lot cleaner now because of this outfall tunnel. Again, 10 miles out to sea under the ocean floor. And the workers had to go out and pull the plugs out. Now, we talked about the distance just having to cover and that this is so different from what divers would normally have to do. So what were some of the schemes that were considered for just being able to breathe and to get these guys down to the end of the tunnel for that matter?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point because although, as I explained, commercial divers take on really difficult jobs that have high risk embedded into them, they take on calculated risks because they want to survive, and they're not cavalier about that. I grew to appreciate the seriousness with which they approach their jobs and risk. The longer I spent with these guys and in the understanding the subculture. But here was a place that was so far out that their conventional breathing supplies, which would be pre-mixed high-pressure, it's called HP bottled air. You know, you see those tanks in the hospital of oxygen that's kind of brought in on there. That was what normally you would use in a setting like this. But it was too far out, and the concern was that you would use up most of your supply just getting, it took hours just to get out to the end point of the tunnel and then get back, and you wouldn't have enough to actually do the work of pulling out these plugs, because on top of everything else, I mean, if your listeners want to just envision this, and I would urge them, if they want to see visuals of this, to go to trappedunderthesea.com, because I've got maps and video and background on these divers, but that will give you a sense of what they're actually asked to do. But again, at the end, the tunnel is just 5 feet wide, and these plugs are nestled deep inside these 30-inch wide pipes, which are scarcely wider than the diver's shoulders. And they have to crawl into them in this slippery, algae-laden pipes in the dark while breathing off this experimental mixed gas breathing system, because it was what the engineer and project manager came up with as a way to handle that huge distance problem of we can't truck in enough and carry enough given the confines and the distance of conventional breathing supplies, so let's just mix liquid nitrogen and liquid oxygen and have the divers breathe that mix down there in the tunnel.
Wow. But, you know, just when I'm trying to, I'm measuring 30 inches with my hands here, that's 2.5 feet. So, yeah, not much wider than the shoulders. I guess it's not quite so narrow that they'd have to go in with their arms already up, but then they got to drag the breathing equipment in with them too, don't they?
Exactly. And they can't dislodge that breathing equipment because they're on a hose that's connected, that runs for more than 1,000 feet back to the supply of the mixed gas breathing system. And if they dislodge their equipment, again, one or two breaths of that tunnel air is fatal. So they've got to do this incredible choreography of getting to these remote spots in the dark, moving these plugs that are heavy, about 65 pounds. They look like a big salad bowl in an industrial-sized kitchen, but they have rusted, in many ways, fasteners in them that have to be pried off because they've been in there for years and years in this cold, forbidding environment, and they have to be pulled out, and then the diver has to extricate himself from the pipe while dragging the plug above his head and sliding down the fasteners by his body down and pushing them out by his feet and get each of those out, and has to do that 55 times.
That's just, it sounds impossible. And then, of course, there's the question, you're pulling a plug out, which if you're thinking in terms of a bathtub, which is not a good analogy here apparently, but you're thinking that there's something on the other side of that, but there isn't?
There isn't, because, and this goes to really fundamental question in this story, and one of the things that I think I should stress is that the particulars, as you probably have gathered, of this story are so specific to this job, and they probably will never be repeated again. But the forces that put this in motion, that created the problem and the drama and ultimately the success story, are, I think, universal to grand undertakings with high ambition and high engineering risk and ambition. So I think it has lots of lessons in it for how we do these great things, because I do feel as a society we shouldn't shy from taking on these projects. This was an enormous success ultimately in transforming something for the public good, but it didn't have to go this way. And I think that's one of the themes in the book, is when kind of the organizational behavior nature to this, when smart people can't get along, you have to remember what you're asking these blue-collar workers to do. In this case, the risk was so many parties were worried about keeping risk from their own balance sheets and offloading it onto other parties, that at the end of the day, that risk rested squarely on the shoulders of these five men who were asked to do this impossible job.
So the five guys, and you do a good job, I've kind of glossed over that, but you do a good job letting us know who these people are, DJ Gillis in particular. Who were they? I mean, it seems like to get to these five guys, there must have been about 50 or 500 who said no. And was there a great payoff at the end? I mean, was this going to make them rich for life if they finished this successfully?
You think it would, right? Because of what they were being asked to do. Again, you know, the longest tunnel of its kind in the world, the first mission like this. Part of the appeal for them was to make history in their field. I mean, these guys are used to dealing with risk, but they were kind of told that, you know, people would be talking about this in the trades for years to come on what they did. So I think that was part of the appeal. Divers is kind of an itinerant bunch. You have to move around to where the work is. And so in this case, these divers were, they came from two different companies, one from the Pacific Northwest in Washington State and one from in New England. And they were kind of cobbled together. It was an arranged marriage, which added to the complexity of this, and only given about 2 weeks to get to know each other, versus, as I explore in the book, how NASA trains for a high-risk mission, and they have their teams spend a year at least getting to know each other. These guys were given 2 weeks. The money was decent. I mean, it was certainly good for what they're doing, but I don't think it was in any way commensurate with what the risk they were being asked to do. It was about $700 a day while they were working in the tunnel, which was a couple of weeks of work, and then a little less for training going into that of a couple of weeks before that. So not a huge payday by any means, given what they were asked to do. And clearly the other thing is they thought they were being asked to do one thing, and that the plans had all been worked out for what this equipment, this innovative breathing system they were given. As I show in the book, that didn't happen. That despite having a year to work on this plan, the system was improvised and not ready for prime time. And all these very smart people either signed off on it or looked the other way because there was such a desire for this project to be done.
So, and we haven't even talked about how they got to the end of the tunnel, at least close to the end of the tunnel, which involves. It just, some of this stuff is just so unlikely, but there's a couple of Hummers down there, basically.
Yeah, yeah, and the Hummers also need oxygen to operate, so they had to be retrofit in order to work on that way. And they took a pair of Humvees, one going east to the end of the tunnel and one facing west on a trailer for the drive back, because once they got as far as they could into the tunnel, and it was only part of the way that you could drive in this treacherous terrain with the Humvees, but at a certain point the width of the tunnel choked down so much that you couldn't even open the doors all the way, never mind turn it around. So that's why they needed one going facing west for the drive back.
Do the guys who made it back, and I'm trying not to give away too much at the end of the story, although people can find this out pretty easily online, the guys who made it back, do they have any regrets about attempting this in the first place?
Absolutely. I think they all do. Not have, it's not that they have regrets taking on a difficult job. One of the survivors of the divers now works as a SAT diver, a saturation diver, who I told you at the beginning of the show is the highest level of the field now, taking enormous risks, but he takes only very calculated risks. I think their regrets are that they didn't demand more answers when they started to see problems and were raising concerns, and the project manager, who was a very bright guy, but wasn't great in emotional intelligence and kind of getting the most out of them and kind of closed down, their complaint seemed to end with him rather than being escalated up to the people who were really in charge of this project. And the divers who survived, I think, regret not having unified and refused to go back in until their demands were listened to.
Well, Boston Harbor is indeed cleaner for the outfall tunnel having been completed, but boy, what it took to do it is well told in Trapped Under the Sea, One Engineering Marvel, Five Men, and a Disaster, 10 Miles into the Darkness. Neil Swidey wrote it, and he joined us on The Exchange. Neil, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeffrey. It's been a pleasure.
Good to have you. Monday on the Jefferson Exchange, we will talk about the state of the art in emergency medical service. We'll talk about a culture of peace commission being proposed for Ashland and what that would mean. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the author of The Naked Future about how much information is out there in the world about us and our habits and our likes and dislikes, and what happens to all that information when it's out of our hands. That's all in The Naked Future. That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duran, who's also at the controls today, with Liam Moriarty as well alongside. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again Monday at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great first weekend of spring.